Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and him, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. It's questions day, Kieran, but there are some big news stories, probably the biggest being that I support a club that's so generous and was so keen to make sure this was an amicable pod. We scored both goals on Friday night.
Well, yes, it would have been a challenge otherwise for Palace to score two goals, given they only had one shot on target for 90 minutes.
So, yeah, you Brighton fans are obsessed with that sort of statistic, whereas we kind of we kind of tend to count the points that we get off you.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, you know, if it was exactly the same as Selhurst, you didn't deserve a point there, but there you are. But Conor Gallagher's goal, I think, was the first goal ever that Palace has scored from a move that every single player touched the ball. All 11 players. All 11 players touched the ball, which, of course, the BBC didn't mention. Let's talk about some of these news stories, Kieran. The first one being the most topical, as we're recording this on Sunday night, and it's just a couple of hours after Rafa Benitez was not surprisingly sacked. A very terse statement coming from Everton. But again, this is going to cost them a lot of money, isn't it? And they've already spent a lot of money hiring and firing managers in recent years.
That's right. Since Farhad Moshiri acquired Everton Football Club, they've had six managers in 6 years. It wasn't so bad with Ancelotti because effectively Real Madrid took him off their hands, and I think they might have received some compensation. But I know some of the other settlements, they've had to be quite creative in order to both pay off the manager and comply with financial fair play. Judging by the nature of the statement, which you said, very terse, not even thanking Rafa Benitez for his efforts. That does seem a de minimis. I would imagine his advisors will be looking for the full settlement because he signed a contract in good faith as far as he was concerned. Now it hasn't worked out for a variety of reasons, but yes, we've spoken to agents and we've spoken to lawyers, and they say under these circumstances the manager is perfectly entitled to a full and fair settlement of his outstanding wages.
It's strange behaviour from Everton, though, Kieran, which is a club we both like. They just got rid of Digne, apparently in a rivalry between him and the manager won. And then 2 days after getting rid of him, they get rid of the manager. They've sacked their transfer, their player recruitment team. Some of their medical staff have gone. It doesn't strike me as a club that are entirely in control of what's happening behind the scenes, does it?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't a football show, as we've always said. But Rafa Benitez gives the impression of a man that could fall out with people in a telephone box, and he's a complex character, man management isn't his greatest strength. But to have got rid of the medical staff, the recruitment staff, the players, and everybody else, and back the manager in each of those particular disputes, for Everton to then turn around and say, now we're going to fall out with the manager ourselves, does seem to be indicative of a club which needs a long-term strategy.
Yeah, it's like somebody once said about Dennis Wise, he could start a fight in an empty room. No, I couldn't, said Dennis Wise, in an empty room. I'm glad you laughed at that, Kieran, because it was me that said that. The bad news for Brighton as well, and this shows a certain disrespect for your club, is that Graham Potter is second favourite, I think. And it's interesting that there was a discussion on 606 this evening, as Robbie Savage said, well, of course he would leave Brighton for Everton, and Chris Sutton for once saying, why would he do that? But it does show a certain disrespect. I know it's not a football show, Kieran, but we're talking about your manager here, who's doing, and I say this through the most gritted of teeth, a very good job at Brighton. why Everton fans or Everton Football Club would assume that he would want to, of course, go to Everton is slightly confusing, I think.
And why would Everton want to recruit a manager whose side has only won two games in 14?
Fair point. That's true.
Would be my view. Yeah. He had the opportunity to potentially go to Spurs last summer. That didn't take place. He's on a long-term contract, so it would be expensive for Everton. Brighton have gone 10 games a season without a victory. And you know, the nature of the club being where we are with our expectations is that we just suck it up. I think Everton fans are probably more impatient than that. And I don't think they would be prepared to accept it. I think their eyes are firmly on either Duncan Ferguson or Wayne Rooney because of the emotional links with the club. And you can understand that appeal.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? Get rid of a manager with years of experience and bring in somebody with barely any experience at all. But he once played for us, so that makes perfect sense. Before we get on to the big story, which I'm afraid, again, is Derby County, we spoke last week, Kieran. We asked the Premier League if they were listening, if they would clarify the rules and regulations for games being called off in the current pandemic. Palace, for example, had five players unavailable against Spurs because of COVID. Tottenham, Arsenal had one, but yet the game was called off because they were short of players for injury reasons, for AFCON reasons, even though they let two players go out on loan earlier this week. And Tottenham, absolutely furious, are demanding that Arsenal reimburse those Tottenham fans that had already travelled from Ireland and Scandinavia to see the game.
You can understand Tottenham's frustration. I mean, the utilisation of COVID as a means of matches not taking place, I think people are now starting to get a bit twitchy about it. Arsenal got a good result at Anfield on Thursday in terms of the first leg of the Carabao Cup. Would they therefore be better off with their players having a longer gap between the next leg? A cynic might say they would. As you know, I'm not a cynic. In terms of Spurs' claim, it ain't going to work. And also, I can say from I had tickets to see Brighton play at Manchester United. The Premier League brought forward the kickoff of that to 12:30 on a Saturday. Yeah. So I had to book a train on a Friday. I had to book a hotel. That match was called off. I lost out. I'd be pretty peeved, as would fans of all clubs up and down the country who have to shift around at the behest of TV companies. And we know the rules. We don't get any compensation. So I think what Spurs are doing is populist, and you can understand the reason why they've done it. But it's not got a prayer of making progress.
Speaking briefly of populist measures, my club, Crystal Palace, being the angels that they are subsidising the away travel for Hartlepool fans for the fourth round of the FA Cup, which is a relatively inexpensive gesture, Kieran, but one that will be appreciated by a lot of people.
Yeah, I think again, through gritted teeth, well done, Palace. It's the right thing to do. I think it's showing an element of understanding for those clubs in the lower leagues who have suffered financially on the back of COVID to a greater extent than clubs in the Premier League itself. And it gives Hartlepool fans a chance for a big day out. It's a fourth round of the FA Cup. It's at a Premier League ground. It's just a shame that those Premier League clubs who do have matches, which when they are the home team against lower league opposition, that why don't they pick up 100% of the VAR cost? Because they can afford it. I think it's harsh in the FA Cup that some clubs got knocked out in the last round because they're only in the EFL and therefore they didn't have the licence for the FA Cup. And Premier League clubs do get the benefit of that. And sometimes you don't get the benefit. We've all seen VAR decisions. But again, I think it would be a great gesture by all Premier League clubs to say, we know where we are. We benefit so much from cameras in football. Well, these cameras, which are VAR cameras, we're going to bear the cost of. And it's, I think it's about $9,000, something like that. So it's not a fortune.
Yeah. These are dark days for Derby fans, Kieran. This time last week, there were glimmers of optimism when it looked like Mike Ashley was a serious bidder for the club and may well still be. But this weekend has seen some worrying developments. The EFL have asked that Derby prove that they are financially able to see out the rest of the season and fulfil their fixtures. There's a new transfer embargo on them, which has led to Jagielka leaving and going to Stoke. Rumours on BBC yesterday that the EFL were blocking a potential takeover. Why they would do that, I don't know. And something we didn't talk about last week, partly because we got distracted by your dog, is the the role of Wickham and Middlesbrough in this. And it seems that that is a major stumbling block in any new takeover. Now, we know Middlesbrough have had beef with Derby for some time. I'm not entirely sure what the current problem is with Wickham and Middlesbrough, but there's quite a lot to unpick in basically 24 hours worth of news for Derby fans.
Yes, yeah, it's been a bad 48 hours for Derby. And the tragedy of all this is it takes away from the amazing achievement.
Absolutely.
Despite having a 21-point yep. penalty, they're now off the bottom of the Championship. A lot of credit's got to be given to Wayne Rooney. I have spoken to people who've been affected by this at Derby County.
Yeah.
And they have nothing but praise for him. They have nothing but contempt for the former owner, Mel Morris. And I'm going to unpick some of this. First of all, if we go back to day zero and the appointment of the administrators, Quantuma, they're not a particularly well-known firm. They have had a football administration before. We have to be honest about that. I spoke to somebody in the insolvency industry, and they said, this Derby County is a big club.
Yeah.
Why aren't the big insolvency companies involved with this? It would be a good job for them. And they all turned around to me and said they wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. Uh-huh. It was seen as very, very risky.
Right.
Quantum will get a good fee out of this. They'll get a couple of million quid, but the big firms, they're concerned that it might not be a success. The insolvency business is one where you are judged on results.
Yeah.
Secondly, in terms of prospective buyers, what exactly are you buying? Well, the one big elephant in the room is that Derby County don't own the stadium. Yeah. Mel Morris had transferred the stadium to another one of his companies. Well, why didn't he put that into administration as well? Again, under the umbrella of Quantuma, and then they could sell the whole package. So that has been queried again by people in the industry. And as I used to work in the industry. I've still got friends, acquaintances, let's be honest, who do. So I always go to them. They say that they find that a bit strange. And then I started digging a bit further. And I went onto the BBC website when one of my insolvency mates said, just take a look at Section 71. So, it's like a moth to a flame for me when somebody mentioned the section number of the Insolvency Act. And under that, an administrator is in the position to try to force the sale of an asset which is linked to an administration, which is under a charge. So if they did that, then the administrators could potentially try to force the sale of Pride Park and at a fair price, and that would help them in terms of their ability to sell the overall package. So that's strange. How are Derby surviving? Because the wages have got to be paid, and I think this is where the EFL have come in. And they're saying, well, it's going to cost you a few more million if you're going to carry on not selling the club. So where's that money going to come from? Perhaps they've not had answers, in which case that's why they're concerned about the future. There's nothing to stop the administrators from selling a player or two, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of action in that. And, we had a few jibes at the administrators of Wigan Athletic, but the one thing that they did do was that they were very good at selling the assets which could be sold, i.e. the training ground was sold to Preston, and quite a few players were sold. Yeah, they were sold at bargain prices, but you know, the clubs that benefited from that included Derby County.
Yeah. Kieran, can I just interrupt you there? Because I don't need to get too far down the stream before I forget. As I want to get a couple of clarifications. This sure. idea of the EFL asking for proof that Derby County can financially see out the rest of the season, that's not unusual, is it? They've done that to other clubs before.
Yeah, all clubs are supposed to be able to show, sort of, yeah, certainly in terms of proof of funds. And I get the impression that because of the nature of the appointment relatively early in the season, that the EFL should have and probably did ask this when the administrators were appointed. They didn't push on getting an answer, and I don't think they've had much of an answer. So nobody knows how the administrators have paid the bills to date.
Right.
Now, the vibe that I'm getting is that it's potentially come from MSD Holdings, who have a mortgage over Pride Park, but I may be wrong. I can't see who else would have done it, unless Mel Morris has done it. But things, if Mel Morris had done that, we would have heard about it.
Yes,
Mel Morris would have told everybody.
Yeah, from the administrator's point of view as well, the value of Pride Park, is Mel Morris's inflated valuation of it several years back, which was part of the initial problem, is that an issue for the administrators now in terms of, not that they can sell it because it doesn't belong to them at the moment, but is that overestimated value a problem?
Well, first of all, let us say for legal reasons that it was deemed to be not an overestimated
okay.
value, because when the EFL did charge Derby County, Derby's independent valuer successfully managed to say that it was worth £81 million. There was talk about it having a sliding roof at the time, which did seem a bit strange, but I don't think that was actually included. So I don't think it was. It's how much of a loss on the £81 million is Mel Morris willing to take.
Right.
The bigger the loss he's prepared to take, then the easier it's going to be potentially for a new owner to come in. Because without that, what exactly are they buying? They're buying the name.
Yeah.
Because the players are on relatively short contracts now. They've not signed anybody apart from short-term contracts this season. And, you know, Phil Jagielka's gone. I think Sam Baldock might be going as well because his contract was due to expire around about the same time. So that's where we are with that. And then we come on to Middlesbrough and Wickham. And I think Middlesbrough's view is that Derby got into the playoffs in 2019.
Yeah.
Middlesbrough finished 1 point behind. And in their view, Derby had not submitted their accounts on time, or they had used an inappropriate amortization policy. And on the back of that, Derby had managed to recruit players which perhaps Middlesbrough want to have signed. So Middlesbrough feel that they had been denied an opportunity to get into the playoffs and therefore the Premier League. As far as Wickham are concerned, Wickham were relegated on the last day of the season. Derby stayed up. Wickham's viewpoint, and remember we had the Wickham owner on the show.
Yeah.
His view was that, again, had Derby submitted their accounts on time, they would have exceeded the limits for financial fair play, profitability and sustainability. They would have therefore been given a points deduction last season. And on the basis of that, Wickham Wanderers would have stayed in the Championship, and that's worth around about £6 million in TV money. Now, are these claims spurious or not? Well, I'm not a lawyer. You're not a lawyer. We're pub lawyers, but that's as far as it goes. There are two viewpoints. First of all, Derby County fans themselves have pointed out, well, hold on, they got to the playoff finals in 2014, and they lost in the playoff final to Queen's Park Rangers, who were subsequently found to have been in breach of financial fair play. So therefore, should Derby have sued Queen's Park Rangers? I don't know. But should they be therefore trying to get some form of financial recompense from Queen's Park Rangers? All that we know is that they haven't. We don't know whether they did claim or not in private, but there's nothing came through. So that would appear to support Derby's position today. The opposite view is if we go back to 2005, West Ham signed Carlos Tevez when he was subject to third-party ownership. That was therefore in breach of the rules. On the last day of the season, he scored the winning goal. West Ham stayed up. Sheffield United went down. And there was an out-of-court settlement, which is estimated, because it's out-of-court, we don't know the full details, estimated to be in the region of £20 million. So does that give some credence to Wickham and Middlesbrough's case? Well, you know, their fans will say yes. That's where we are. So we're stuck in the middle. What the administrators have had 3 or 4 months to try to sort this out, and they've not done so. Now, it could be because it's very complex. It could be because they've chosen not to. The EFL's hands are tied, because if the EFL say, well, we're going to make a judgment on this, and it is not a football creditor, and therefore the administrators sell Derby County on the basis of it not being a football creditor, Middlesbrough and Wickham could then sue the EFL for saying, in court, outside of the EFL position itself, could sue the EFL for saying, well, we believe that we are football creditors, therefore you owe us a load of money. And of course, if that's coming out of central EFL coffers, that's less money to distribute between the EFL members. So all of a sudden, you've got 71 highly cheesed off clubs. So that's it. It's a mess.
Kieran, I really want to move on to questions, but
absolutely.
But everything you say raises other issues. There's two things there. And what frustrates me, and it must really infuriate Derby fans, is it really shouldn't matter a toss how much of a loss Mel Morris is willing to accept on Pride Park. It should have nothing to do with him anymore, but them's the rules, unfortunately. The Wickham Middlesbrough thing I don't understand, because Derby don't actually owe them. All the implications are, when you read the BBC reports, when you read other newspaper reports, is you would take away the feeling that Wickham and Middlesbrough are owed money by Derby County. Now, they've got a grudge against Derby County, which, if I was a Wickham or Middlesbrough fan, I would wholeheartedly endorse. But Derby don't actually owe them any money, so I don't see how they can be creditors and how they're the fly in the ointment of any move going through. You're talking about potential legal claims, possibly 2 or 3 years down the line. So, but you're saying that's enough to put off any potential investor in the club?
Well, if I was Mike Ashley or any other potential buyer, I would be seeking indemnities from the administrators to say that I am not liable for the debts of Derby County. You know, because one of the things that you do when you buy any company out of administration is that you buy the assets and not the liabilities.
Yeah.
So that's where we're now. Yeah, you know, whilst I've been very critical of the bloke, Mel Morris could sort all of this out in an instance. All he has to do is to say that he will underwrite Derby's defence in any claims from Wickham Wanderers and Middlesbrough Football Club. He is a wealthy man. He claims to be a Derby County fan, although he only seems to be in it for the good bits and not the bad. And yeah, you know, we know that. We're in football for the misery as much as the pleasure. Yeah, that's the contract we sign at the age of 7, and that's the contract that we continue to have until the day we die. So, you know, I think Mel Morris could become the saviour of Derby County. He could he could transfer the asset in some way to the administrators, or put Pride Park, the company, rather he could put the company which owns Pride Park into administration rather than keep it under his own remit. And he could also agree to personally defend Derby County and pay for any settlement if these claims are legitimate. Now, it could be that they are spurious, and if they are spurious, then he walks away a happy man.
Yeah, that sound you can't hear, Kieran, is the sound of me not holding my breath.
Yes.
You're right about the misery, though, but at least Palace fans had the misery in the 87th minute the other night, rather than the 98th minute, as usual. At least we got it over and done with 11 minutes earlier, rather than the Premier League's usual diktat that we carry on playing till Brighton score. Let's finally get on to questions, and we've got some good questions as always. We're heading towards Match of the Day 2 time, Kieran. That's how dedicated we are. For various reasons, we couldn't do this till Sunday night. Our first question comes from Ali Keith. And Ali says, can a club chairman decide to pay an agent his fee for an incoming transfer with an investment in one of the agent's businesses rather than with cash?
Absolutely. I think this is a very cunning plan, yeah, as Baldrick would say. You know, whether or not the agent would be willing for a club owner to own a percentage in the agency and therefore, you know, potentially get dividends from it, potentially get money should the agency be sold, is another issue. But the advantage of this from the club's perspective is normally the agent's fee is added to the transfer fee, and then that is amortized and that goes into your FFP calculation. So it does increase the cost for the club. If this was done by some sort of private arrangement between the agent and the club owner, all of that would be, in theory, outside of the remit of the football agencies, and it would save the club money. So it's potentially something that could be done. Would the agent want to be owned by Mel Morris or Steve Dale or the Glazers? Yeah, that's another matter.
So there are no rules and regulations to prevent a club chairman having interest in an agency then?
I don't see why not. I mean, if you take a look at what we have at Wolves, yeah, they've got Mendes as a special advisor.
Yeah.
You know, we've been football fans long enough to know that the offspring of certain high profile people in football have ended up being agents and have managed to influence deals on the back of that. So yeah, I think it would be a difficult one to prevent from an institution's point of view. And then, of course, you know, if they do say that the club owner doesn't do it, well, you just get the club owner's son or the club owner's partner or whatever it's going to be to make that investment instead.
Yeah. Every now and again, Kieran, I see a question and I speculate as to what the answer might be. On this occasion, I didn't bother. I didn't even begin. I didn't get as far as yes in speculate. I didn't get as far as peculate. Connor Downey's question is, thank you for this question, Connor. Would a club amortise...
Not as much as I'm thanking him.
Yeah, Connor, no, I thought you'd like this. I thought this might make your weekend. if you couldn't get 3 points off Palace, this question would be almost as good a bonus. Would a club amortise the whole cost of a transfer, or is a residual value accounted for? What happens if the player stays at the club beyond the original contract? Is the player revalued and amortised again, or do they just remain on the balance sheet at the residual value? Surely they aren't just removed from the balance sheet.
Okay, the residual value is the value of a football player at the end of his contract. Now, because of the Bosman ruling, the player is legally entitled to move to another club on a free transfer. So therefore, the residual value is automatically zero. If the contract is extended, what you do is that you then reduce the amortization charge. Let's say that we sign a player on a four-year contract for 20 million quid. So that's £5 million worth of amortization each year. At the end of year one, his value is therefore 20 less 5, that's 15, and the player signs an extension. He signs a three-year extension, so now he's got another 5 years to go. So you would now say, well, his value is 15. Instead of having 3 years left on his contract, he's now got 5 years left on his contract. 15 divided by 5 gives us an amortization figure of 3 million. And this is what we were actually discussing last week in relation to Barcelona and Umtiti, that they've managed to reduce the amortization charge. It's unfortunately the type of sleight of hand that exists too often in the world of finance and accounting.
Our next question comes from Paul, just Paul. So Paul might be modest or he might be a model. I don't know. Paul says, I have a question about out-of-contract players. Usually if you go out of contract with an employer, I would expect you to stop getting paid by them, and so you stop working for them. Is that what happens in football, or do clubs generally keep paying players until their negotiations are completed to renew or sign elsewhere?
Well, most employees do not have fixed-term contracts.
That's true.
So yeah, I've got a contract of employment with the university, and it will last until A, I retire, B, they realise I'm a complete fraud and sack me, or C, I'm offered work elsewhere. So, yeah, and under those terms, you normally have to give a statutory period of notice, both parties, and you are paid up until the date of the notice. With football, it is slightly different because you do it is a fixed-term contract. At the end of the contract, the player can go elsewhere. Now, what we will often see is, especially in the lower leagues, where there are normally 700 to 800 players out of contract each summer. And what many of them will do is that they might end up signing a weekly deal. So let's say that you are a left back. The manager doesn't particularly want you, but they've not managed to sign somebody else. So the club might put you on a weekly contract. That helps you because you're trying to find a new employer. That helps the club because they might be able to come back to you and say, look, we've not signed anybody else. Do you fancy a one-year deal? So that's the way it tends to work. And the player benefits because the player, he or she, will be able to be kept in training at the club's premises, get the benefit of the physios and so on. The club benefits is because they then got the potential of being able to offer turnaround to the player, and the player will say, well, yeah, they've been decent enough to me. They give me a weekly contract. Now they want to turn it into 12 months. I'll sign on.
This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by the AI-powered workspace Notion. What if you had access to tomorrow's tools today? In Notion, you do. It's the AI-powered workspace where any team can turn ideas into action.
My career is sort of a bit like being a butterfly, and I'm always jumping from project to project. So therefore, Notion helps me from summarizing meetings notes and automatically generating action items to getting answers to any question in seconds. If you can think it, you can make it. And Notion is for everyone, whether you're a Fortune 500 company or a freelance football finance lecturer.
You can try Notion for free when you go to notion.com/priceoffootball. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/priceoffootball, and start turning ideas into action. That's notion.com/priceoffootball.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Now, I couldn't begin to answer Connor Downey's question, but I suspect a lot of people listening to this pod would think they know the answer to this question, because it's something I think we all discuss. Brian Frame asked this question about Ronaldo's transfer to Juventus. Is there a way, says Brian, to quantify the economic value of that deal? For example, does the club's association with Ronaldo help promote commercial partnership deals as players start/continue to individually brand themselves? Do clubs consider the impact of their personal brands on organisational revenue sources? Now, I think the reason most fans think they would be able to answer this is because everyone assumed that regardless of his footballing ability, Juventus were on a good deal here because they were going to suddenly sell 2 million more shirts, get loads more contracts and get way more money than they spent on bringing Ronaldo into the club.
Yes, absolutely. Juventus, in my opinion, show the most detailed accounts in world football. And not only to do that, they publish them in English as well as Italian. So they're one of my favourite clubs for that, as well as having historically one of the best shirts in football. Cristiano Ronaldo signed for Juventus in July 2018. From Real Madrid, the transfer fee was 100 million euro. If we then look at what happened to the numbers by comparing 2018 to 2019, his first season playing for Juventus, their commercial income shot up by 38 million euro. So, the big sponsors were absolutely delighted. Now, is that all down to Cristiano Ronaldo? No, it's not, but it's certainly a contributor. I thought what was also very interesting is that when I say very interesting, it involves lots of numbers. The average attendance for Juventus' matches didn't change at all. It was 39,000, and that actually shocked me. I always thought Juventus would have huge crowds. But compared to some of the other Italian clubs, yeah, 39,000, it's good, but it's not what you're anticipating. But whilst the average attendance didn't change, I think it went up by a couple of hundred, the value of the ticket sales went up by 14 million euro.
Wow.
What does this tell us? It means that the the commercial department or the hospitality department at Juventus turned round to the prawn sandwich brigade and said, well, you know, last season we were charging you, say, 150 euro per ticket for a box. This season, you're seeing Cristiano Ronaldo, it's now 250 euro. So they managed to get a lot more money. And because the attendances didn't go up, I think, you know, the logic is that they wouldn't have been able to do that to regular fans who would have already bought their season tickets before he signed. So therefore, this must have been additional money extracted from the hospitality sector. So you add those two together, and he brought in, I think it could be a thick end of 50 million euro.
Yeah. I'm not sure what the prawn sandwich brigade in Italy eat, Kieran, but I'm pretty sure it won't be prawn sandwiches. I think wealthy Italian fans would probably be a little bit cross if they were just offered prawn sandwiches. It's an interesting question as well. When you buy somebody as big as Ronaldo, when their personal brand, they're, you know, who makes the money, Ronaldo or the club? But and clearly, the club has made as much money out of it as Ronaldo did.
Yeah, I mean, if you take a look at Cristiano Ronaldo, 390 million followers on Instagram, and he's now, I think there is now a CR7 cologne, there is CR7 underwear, and it gets an awful lot of likes. You know, he's pretty metrosexual guy, as we know, and appeals to a very broad audience.
Yeah, I bet he doesn't follow people back, though, does he? a related, similar question from Darren Leonard is in relation to Heung-min Son extending his contract at Spurs by 4 years. And Darren says, how much is Son worth to Spurs in international commercial revenue and profile raising in the Far East? Can a monetary value be placed on that? Is this something that will be considered in his contract extension as well as him being an absolutely phenomenal player, obviously? And this is interesting for Palace fans, because when we signed Fang Zhi and Sun Jihai, the understanding was that we would make an awful lot of money from the Chinese market. Whether that was the case, I don't know. But there's this same assumption as with Ronaldo, that Tottenham are not only getting the services of a very good player, they're getting access to markets that they might not be getting access to.
Yeah, and I think linked to one of the stories we started off the show with, I've been to Spurs' new stadium. You have as well. The one thing I noticed at the megastore was, blimey, there's an awful lot of South Korean people here, and they've all got Son shirts on. So he is a national hero. He certainly does contribute towards the coffers of the club. If we take a look again, all I can do is quote numbers. Spurs commercial revenue in 2015, which was the last season before he joined, was 60 million quid. Now, also, you know, we've got to be honest, it was before they moved to the new stadium. By the time we got to 2020, 5 years later, it had gone up to 162. That's not all down to Son. Yeah, that's partly due to the movement to the new stadium. But he certainly helps, because you know, whenever Spurs are playing, there's always a camera crew from South Korea. He is very feted. If we remember when Paul Gascoigne went to Italy, you know, all of a sudden we had Italian football being shown on Channel 4 on Sunday afternoon. And there were people going around with Gazza shirts. So in England, so it does make a difference. Being able to put a definitive figure on it is impossible, because you can never really work out these values. But I can assure you that Song's agent will have factored this into all discussions with the club, because, you know, they're not going to undervalue the commercial appeal of their clients.
You know, Kieran, you know, yeah, you're one brother from another mother, Kieran. You know how much I respect you. You know how fond I am of you in a way that only men can be fond of other middle-aged men. But it does sometimes worry me, Kieran, that you spend a lot of time in the megastore of away grounds instead of doing what normal people do, which is either wait in a pub until as close to kick off as possible or get to the ground as early as possible and drink there. You seem to scuttle into the megastore and just have a quick look round. It worries me, Kieran. It worries me.
Well, I'm not going to be drinking the alcohol. And, yeah, I'm also, I think we probably established, I'm a bit of a snob when it comes to the pies as well.
Ah, see, that's why you get sent the pies and I get nothing. Phil Chater is a friend of the show, and Phil has a question about an episode last year and also last week. And Phil says, in an episode last year, you talked about the greedy six-team Liverpool trying to copyright the word Liverpool. And last week, we talked about Brighton and West Brom actually copyrighting Albion. Several years ago, says Phil, I remember Victoria Adams, Posh Spice, trying to copyright the word posh. And this came to my attention due to Peterborough United's nickname being the Posh. I assume that as Peterborough are still the Posh, she lost the case. Have you got any information? There's a friend of mine who's actually probably the only properly posh person I know, just gets absolutely furious about the fact that Posh Spice calls herself Posh. He says, well, she's only posh compared to the other four, isn't she? She probably came from a bigger council house, which is because I like him, I let him get away with shit like that. But it's an interesting one because I probably should have referred to it last week. We talked about, amusingly, the Brighton West Brom copywriting Albion thing. Liverpool did try to copyright the word Liverpool, and she did try to copyright the word posh and presumably lost.
Yeah, well, actually, one of my mates went out with Melanie Chisholm before she joined the Spice Girls. And I've got a lot of respect for her. I think, you know, as a musician, she's actually tried to develop a career, and fair play to her. Because he was from the Widnes Way, and he did confirm that she was sporty.
She was, she's also very nice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I've met her a few times. She's lovely. She's very intelligent.
Yeah. 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 So definitely, she's always been my favourite. Spice Girl.
Can we not have this conversation? Kieran, Twitter are going to love this. The fact that we're talking about our favourite Spice. For the record, I don't have a favourite Spice Girl. Never have done.
Right. Okay. But back to Peterborough. Now, I think Phil's got this slightly the wrong way around. In 2002. Peterborough United Football Club sought to register the words posh and the posh as a right and trademark. And they're perfectly entitled to do that. And what happens is that, you know, we do actually have a friend who is a trademark lawyer, so I should have consulted him beforehand, but I forgot to do so.
bye-bye, BAFTA. There you go. There's always a moment, isn't there?
But my understanding is that what happens is you say you put into the you sort of register with, you know, we intend to use this word or this phrase, and are there any objections? And an objection came in from Victoria Adams, I think it might be the time, or was it Beckham? I'll lose track. But came in from Victoria's representatives to say, my client has been known as Posh Spice since the formation of the Spice Girls, and therefore we are concerned that this would impact upon her ability to sell a range of goods. And Peterborough, I think, would have been successful, because what happens is that when you put in for a trademark, you cannot use the word posh in respect of all products and services. So what Peterborough are trying to do is to prevent the hooky scarves, the hooky shirt brigade, who sometimes turn up outside grounds, especially if they've got, you know, an FA Cup match against a bigger team. And you've seen these monstrosities of half-and-half scarves. Well, it's to stop the half-and-half scarf brigade from utilising the word posh. It would not have stopped Victoria Beckham from selling her line of products, clearly her clothing and you know, accessories and things like that. So it did seem to be a bit of a spurious opposition, but it was good publicity for Peterborough at the time.
Yeah, I suggested at the time that Posh Spice should bring out a range of Peterborough scarves. Mel B wouldn't even pass, Mel C wouldn't even pass that on to her, that suggestion. Interesting that the posh nickname, even though it's only from the 20s, no one could really agree on why the posh people started being the posh, but the consensus is it was ironic because they very much weren't. Right. The gentlemen who made up the new club were of the Uncle Terry background, shall we say, rather than my friend who works for the Royal Family background. Our next question comes from Sam Young, and it's an interesting one because this is a phrase that is suddenly on everybody's lips, probably, I think, because of Sky, who don't like to admit that they haven't got absolute details, so they use this phrase. So Sam Young says, when Manchester United signed Jadon Sancho and Raphael Varane in the summer, they announced that they had agreed a deal in principle for the players before announcing the players officially a few days later. Why do they announce deals in principle first? Is it that they have agreed fees, contracts, etc., and are simply waiting for all the signatures from the relevant authorities? But could this not leave the clubs vulnerable to being embarrassed if the deal falls through at the last minute? And as I say, I'm fairly certain this is probably to do with Sky having rumour, gossip, and wanting to announce it, but not being able to say that the deal has actually been done. So they say, we understand that there has been a deal in principle. Well, although Sammy's right, United did actually use those words themselves.
Yeah. The difference, I think, is between Manchester United and nearly every other club is that Manchester United PLC are listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And what you are obliged to do is that all major issues in relation to the company should be released in such a way that it doesn't give anybody insider information which is deemed to be price sensitive. So if Manchester United had signed a player in principle and they didn't announce it and some people on the inside knew about it, they could buy shares or sell shares, make money or lose money or whatever. So Manchester United have to play this absolutely by the book. So what happened, and you're absolutely right, if you go onto the Manchester United website, it said in respect to Jadon Sancho, I think this was on the 1st of July, we have in principle signed Jadon Sancho with his existing club, subject to A, a medical, and B, agreeing final contract terms. Now, let's be honest, the contract terms have actually been agreed way in advance of this. Yeah, that's the one of the first things they sorted. At the time, of course, Jadon Sancho was part of the England squad for Euro 2020. He didn't want to disappear to go up to Manchester for a while, whilst the focus is very much on trying to assist England in winning the competition. And therefore, United, I think, did the right thing. And it could be embarrassing if it all goes wrong, but he's in the England squad. He's been playing superbly for Borussia Dortmund. So the chances of him failing a medical are remote. But you and I are both old enough to remember. Was it Asa Hartford?
Yeah.
Hole in the Heart.
Hole in the Heart, yes.
Yeah, that's one for the kids, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sometimes a medical can do this, but that tends to be the exception. We are dealing with very fit professional athletes here.
Yeah, I would definitely fail a medical at the moment with the cold I've got. And it is a cold. I've had all the tests. You must have announced to me about 100 times that Man United are listed on the New York Stock Exchange, and it still comes as a surprise every time you mention it. I was going, oh, yes, oh, of course, yes, he has mentioned that before. That'll be the answer. It's not because Sky are dicking about. It's because United are listed on the Stock Exchange. Speaking of which, my attention span, Louis Wishlade starts his question by saying, I remember reading somewhere, which is the level of research that I tend to do. That's the level of research I'm working on. I'm sure I read this somewhere, Kieran. Man United on the New York Stock Exchange? I don't know. Someone's told me that somewhere. But Louis Wishlade says, I remember reading that La Liga has a transfer system where the buying club negotiates a fee for a player with a selling club and then uses the league as an escrow account of sorts for the transfer fee. Is this correct? And if so, could this solve the problem seen in the EFL where clubs are being sold to unsuitable owners, i.e. the EFL is used as a third-party escrow account for the transfer of ownership, allowing them more control and greater security checks? It might be worthwhile. I know what it means, Kieran, because of the fantastic episode of The Simpsons. And I assume most of the people watching this know what it means. But just for some people who don't know what an escrow account is,
An escrow account is normally held by a legal firm, and it's independent of the lawyer's own bank account. It's purely for client purposes. And what happens is that the buyer pays money into this account. It is then held there in trust by the lawyers until the contract has been signed, and they then release the funds to the other party. So, you're going to sell your car to me, and I don't know who you are, and you don't know who I am. If I say, I've transferred you $5,000 for the car, and it's not arrived in your account, you don't know whether I'm lying, whether I'm going to try to pull the wool over your eyes. If we agree to do it in escrow, I first of all put the money into an escrow account. I will then perhaps do some checks to make sure that the car's in good nick. So I've shown good faith by putting money into the account. And once all the checks are completed, then the lawyer releases the money to you. So it's a way of giving a layer of protection. Could this work? And as for La Liga, I think it might work for domestic transfers. For international transfers, it gets a little bit more complicated because we enter the realms of UEFA and FIFA. And also, of course, we know that many transfers these days are done in installments. And this is one area where, I've been fairly critical of certain elements of cryptocurrencies. This is where cryptocurrencies could really work quite well, because it would all have to be mandated via the system. But in terms of would it work in terms of an owners and directors test, I don't really see the benefits from the EFL's position, because they are now making sure that there is some form of proof of funds by prospective owners. And once they pay money to the old owner, then if something goes wrong 6 weeks later, 2 months later, as we saw in the case of Wigan Athletic, then it's too late. So I'm not sure that it would necessarily work, because the old owner gets their money and it's not going to stop the new owner from doing the wrong thing. What would potentially work, and one thing I have been keen to promote, is that if you do buy a football club, you have to put money into an independent fund in the same way as we see with travel agents and airlines and so on, so that if something goes wrong, then people are protected.
I haven't got a car, Kieran, so that's not a brilliant analogy. I can't drive like many great artists. although, having said that, I believe Uncle Terry sold quite a few imaginary cars in his time.
Sometimes he sold two cars at once.
Well, you're getting more value for your money there, aren't you?
Exactly.
You're getting a one-off. You're getting a unique car. No one else has got one. I know, actually, loads of people around near Uncle Terry's estate has got cars like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Our final question comes from, again, it's one of those things where people new to this pod would just go, what the fuck are they talking about? BAFTA have already gone. We've ascertained that, so it doesn't matter the bad language we can get away with. Our final question comes from Dennis Hines, and it's a very interesting one. As they all are, of course. Dennis Hines says, last year the papers reported a TV deal for the Serbian Premier League. Again, for new people listening, it might seem that we're dealing with non-topical issues here. It's just that we have so many questions, it takes us a long time to get round to them. So this would have been a topical question when Dennis first asked it. It probably would have said this year or last week, but Kieran, the producer guy, has changed it. Last year, the papers reported a TV deal for the Serbian Premier League had been agreed for a reported €600 million, which is about $513 million, Dennis Hines helpfully adds, over 6 years. So €600 million over 6 years for the Serbian Premier League, 10 times the value of the previous deal. On the face of it, this seems like a huge amount of money for a country like Serbia, with its level of economic development and a population of around about 9 million people. So basically, how are the broadcasters be able to make the numbers work for this deal? Or do you see in a few years' time another cancelled, reneged Premier League rights contract, as happened recently in China and other countries?
Well, I think this is a classic case if something appears too good to be true, it needs a deeper investigation. And what we find with this, and it's a fantastic deal from the point of view of the Premier League. Absolutely fantastic deal.
Can I just clarify, Kieran, I may have read that out badly. This is Serbia paying £600 million for the Premier League. It's not somebody paying £600 million a euro for the Serbian Premier League, is it?
No. The Premier League international rights. And then you say, well, blimey, why on earth would somebody do this? So you find out, I found out who bought the rights, and it's a company called Telecom, which I think is the name of Gary Newman's debut album. I'll just throw that in. Gary Newman once asked me where he could buy a kebab in Manchester. That's the level of celebrity contact I had before I met you, Kevin.
I was about to say he's a nice fellow, Gary Newman, but you've ruined it by saying he asked you where you could get a kebab in Manchester. Where did you direct him?
I directed him to Ali's. Ali's was legendary in Manchester.
Was it?
That saw me through my university years.
Yes, whereas we got one in Tooting called Kebabish. It's not even a kebab, it's ish. Can you imagine being drunk 1:30 in the morning? Imagine being a young goth in a kebab shop and Gary Newman walks in asking for a lamb doner. Underestimated artist, in my opinion, actually, Gary Newman.
I've seen Gary Newman many times. I'm going to see him at the Brighton Centre next year. Yeah, fantastic artist, yeah. Yeah. So this company, Telecom, is government owned. So this is being paid for out of public funds. Now, the Serbian government is quite authoritarian, shall we say.
Yeah.
And the main opposition group is called the United Group. And they were going to bid for the rights, but they got bombed out of it, you know, by the government bid. You know, to try to put this in some form of context, Serbia population of 9 million paying 100 million euro a year as far as this deal, 600 million euro over 6 years. Germany, Austria, and Switzerland between them pay 25 million.
Wow.
And think about how many people live in those three countries. So that France pays 40.
Crikey.
So yeah, absolutely crazy numbers. So why did they do this? It was to prevent an independent opponent getting hold of it. And this company called the United Group is owned by a guy called Dragan Solak, who a couple of weeks ago became the new owner of Southampton FC.
Oh, wow.
So it all starts to tie up. Why did he go and buy Southampton FC? Well, he's now, of course, got a voice at the Premier League. So yeah, the next time the rights come up for a bidding, he might be able to say, well, hold on, you know, you do realise that by doing this, you are helping to restrict opposition to the government of the Serbian Prime Minister. So yeah, it all gets a little bit murky.
So he owns a club that will benefit from his political rival buying the rights to the Premier League.
His company wanted to buy the rights, I think originally, but at a commercial rate. Because he's an opponent to the government, the government said, well, the one thing that they all do in Serbia, they're football mad, aren't they?
They look at
Partizan Belgrade and Red Star and so on. Absolute, you know, fanatical football fans. Premier League, very, very popular there. But it's an awful lot of money for 9 million pounds.
It is,
yeah, 9 million population.
So, but as he is indirectly, he owns a Premier League club, and if the Premier League are getting £600 million over six years from his political rival, so he's. That's really interesting, Kieran, isn't it?
It's a weird one, yeah. But it does show that football is no longer football, is it? Yeah, the fact that it's being used as part of international or regional geopolitics is not floodlights, green grass and burgers, which we associate football with, is it?
Well, having said that, Kieran, geopolitics was the last thing on my mind 87 minutes into the game on Friday night when I was shouting for fuck's sake in the middle of a crowded restaurant. it was the first time Ali and I had been out for quite some time because she's been away on tour, but she's a very understanding person. it almost turned into a kind of Larry David scene, basically. Everybody holding up the phone going, Brighton just fucking scored. that's the third time I've sworn on this pod already. I do apologise for that. That's three times more than I've sworn in a whole year.
It was an emotional evening.
It was an emotional evening, Kieran, but in the end, it was a result that kept this pod going for another couple of weeks.
Yes. We just grumbling at each other.
because for 3 minutes after that, it was like, if he thinks I'm doing the pod on, you just nearly scored in the 197th minute, that was the pod was hanging in the balance. That's a question, Kieran, from Dennis, that's had a more interesting outcome than perhaps I thought it would do. And it's something I think we should be keeping an eye on. That's as you say, the geopolitics is fascinating there. And it's a good question to end. So thank you to everyone who's made a donation to the pod via our Patreon site, including Lee Hine, Ian Crawford, Andy Dawson. And I'm going to read this out because I'm a big man. Seagull Sam, Alex Davidson, Michael Johnson, Sam Bailey, Barra Hoyegaard. I really got that wrong. Simon Slater, and plain old Matt. If you'd like to make a small monthly contribution to the pod, go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com, and I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire for his customary farewell.
Well, thanks again, folks, for all the feedback and all the interactions. We do appreciate you engaging with us. Especially putting us right when we get it wrong. Patreon is one way, and it costs as little as £1 a month, which we appreciate every pound. If you want to give us some good karma in some other ways, press that follow button on Spotify or Apple, and if you could leave us a review, it apparently makes a difference, according to producer guy, as I'm contractually bound to say. we're not quite sure why, because myself and Kevin, our algorithms isn't part of our day to day life. But if you give us a review, if you'd like to give us 5 stars, absolutely fantastic. We always appreciate that. It doesn't matter what you say, apparently, in the review. It's the stars that matter. So you could say you would rather have the show presented by Arnold Schwarzenegger and Bonnie Langford, and it wouldn't make a blind bit of difference to me and Kevin. Our egos can take it. I'm not sure which one of us will be playing Arnie and which one of us will be playing Bonnie.
I'd rather play Bonnie, to be honest. That's all right.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Just a little insight into my current state of mind there, but I'd be happy to play Bonnie. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. All I can say is it's cold outside and the paint's peeling off of our walls.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.